I often think of life and the point of life as a kind of a set of scales. And everybody has the potential to add something to the positive side of the scale. And there's an awful lot of awfulness that is adding to the negative side. Some is preventable, some is not preventable. It's, you know, nothing could have stopped the current virus that we're all battling against from emerging. So that just happened, but there are plenty of things that are preventable that are happening on the negative side of the scale. So I think each of us as a human being has got the potential to add something to the positive side of the scale. And I think it almost doesn't matter what you do, so long as you're adding to the positive and not the negative. Each of us, by being kind to our family and friends and neighbors and colleagues, is adding to the positive side of the scale. I think that's really important. And I chose to be a children's doctor, and I absolutely love that. And I chose to contribute in the way that I do, which is about trying to fix health systems and try to influence the stuff that sits beyond the health systems, which is the bigger stuff, the policy and the politics and poverty and all of those things. So I'm not in politics, and I wouldn't dream of doing so, but I do try to influence it because I think it has such a crucial bearing on health.
Welcome to episode 5 of the second season of the Not Many Adults podcast, Pioneers for Children's Healthcare and Wellbeing. And this week, we're going to be focusing on the wellbeing aspect of our podcast, and we're delighted to welcome Dr. Ingrid Wolf. Dr. Wolf is Director of the Children and Young People's Health Partnership in Lambeth and Southwark in London. She is also a consultant in child public health at the Evelina Children's Hospital, also in London. Ingrid is qualified in paediatrics and public health, which has enabled her to be a children's doctor in a very broad sense of the term. She has on-the-ground insight from clinical practice and a population perspective from public health. These two aspects come together in her academic work, which focuses on children's health services, systems and policy in the UK and European countries. In her NHS work, Ingrid leads the development and evolution of a new model of children's healthcare. Ingrid's goal is to improve UK child health through strengthening and applying science in children's health services, systems, and policy. Ingrid, good morning. Thank you so much for joining us on the Not Many Adults podcast.
Oh, good morning, and thank you ever so much to you both for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Well, so we try and ask people who are listening to the podcast to email us, to come in and tell us about people that we should be talking to. And you were one of those people. So someone from the Evelina Children's Hospital got in touch with us, and that's, you know, that's how we met and started the dialogue that we have. And I guess with that in mind, as a starter, could you just give us a little bit of an overview as to how you got to doing what you're doing at the minute and you know, where that's taken you, please?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, it's a funny thing, isn't it? You get asked these questions, and increasingly, I guess it's a sort of life stage thing. Increasingly young doctors in particular, you know, will ask, oh, how did you get to do what you're doing and so on? And as if it was a plan, and it isn't, Deborah. I mean, it wasn't for me anyway. I never planned anything very well. I sort of pursued what was interesting, and so actually it's a series of sort of accidents and sometimes missteps and often failures and left turns when you meant to do right turns and all sorts of things that just happen in life. And it's a really interesting thing to look back at something, you know, in middle age and think, you know, how did that happen? I didn't plan it that way. You know, years and years ago, I was going to do pediatric intensive care. I was always interested in child health and interested in physiology, and I wanted to do, I wanted to do pediatric intensive care. I don't know. I was going to do something more biomedical and more technical and more acute and all that sort of thing. And then I ended up being, I was always interested in politics and in the social side of medicine. I've always been interested in those things. But I never in a million years thought I would do anything like train in public health. I really didn't. I have to confess that struck me as dull. And, you know, when I was younger, to me, being a doctor was, you know, saving lives and, you know, cardiac arrests and, you know, probably a bit of surgery mixed in before I understood really what it was about. And, you know, and I loved the acute side of it. And I still do. I don't do it now, but I still love it. Of course I do. And so I guess my interest in politics and in the political determinants of health, I would say, as well as politics, not really politics, it's how politics shapes health that interests me. That together with, I guess, an increasing frustration in practicing medicine with it being unable to fix things in the system that I thought were wrong, and also a frustration with not being able to prevent some of the problems that I thought were very preventable. And so I guess anybody who has done anything for a little while will have a collection of little stories of things that has influenced them along the way. And I have lots of those. And one of them, which is fairly straightforward, one of them was staying up all night, looking after a child who had really bad asthma. And it was scary, as asthma is, and it was immensely satisfying to help them and make them feel better. I mean, seeing somebody struggling to breathe is ghastly, and it was immensely rewarding to be able to help. And I felt really good about that, and I'd achieved something nice and everything, and I felt very pleased, and I sent them home the next day and whatever. And then they came back again, and I thought, oh my goodness, what have I achieved? Nothing, you know. It's just going on again and again, and so that's not really satisfactory. So that was one thing. Another story, which is really sort of several children rolled into one, was I'd meet a lot of children who would come to outpatients clinic. I used to run a clinic that was an emergency referral clinic. Now, by emergency, don't mean emergency, we mean sort of urgent, but it was an urgent referral clinic. And so it was for problems that really needed to come to a hospital and be seen by a pediatrician, i.e. they'd gone through either the emergency department or a general practitioner. And so it was a kind of a level up. And yet a lot of what I saw in that clinic was really pretty basic stuff. And I don't mean this in a medical sense, I mean it in a social sense. So I would see a lot of children with you know, problems like tummy aches and constipation, and a lot of really anxious mothers who would come in with, you know, couldn't quite figure out what was the matter. And it would turn out that it was a problem that I really couldn't even begin to fix. And it would take a long time to even get to discuss it. Something like homelessness, you know, it would take a long conversation to draw out what was really worrying them. So in other words, the short answer was, there's nothing wrong with your child, the child is fine. And then you could just say goodbye. But increasingly, I wanted to engage in those conversations and find out really, well, why are you here? What's worrying you? And why have you gone to the trouble of going first to your GP and then a referral and then, you know, what actually is going on? And I started feeling a little, I suppose, unsatisfied with the, this is what looks like a medical problem. You can fix it. You can't fix it. Say goodbye sort of thing. I wanted to think more holistically about what was actually going on. And so I started noticing things like social problems coming into a health setting, homelessness, domestic violence, all kinds of really difficult, difficult things, none of which I was prepared for in my medical training. And then even things like, you know, the really large numbers of children who had come to a specialist clinic with constipation. And I struggled to understand why that was such a medical problem. How could you end up in so much trouble over a common thing that really could be treated, well, ideally should be prevented, and treated with fairly minimal intervention and support. So, you know, what were all the dietary things that were going on that meant that so many children had really problematic constipation? And, you know, people sort of think it's a small problem, but it really isn't in childhood. And when it goes wrong, it goes badly wrong. And children with tummy aches and toilet problems and so on can disrupt sleep, can disrupt family harmony, can disrupt school. It can become it kind of snowballs, right? So it starts off with what is in effect a public health problem. Why aren't children eating well enough? Why aren't they getting enough exercise? What's gone wrong with the way that we feed the nation? And then what's gone wrong with the kind of fear and risk aversion and so on, that this becomes a medical problem rather than a sort of social or a family problem or maybe primary care or whatever. It just struck me that why is this ending up in a kind of specialist medical setting, this kind of thing? And I'm not actually very well equipped to deal with it. Yes, I can do the medical thing, but again, they're just going to come back in again. I was very frustrated about not being able to deal with the causes of problems well enough in the place that I was sitting. So long story short, this is you know, one of those you know, things that happens in life. I just had the opportunity to rethink what I was doing in my career pathway, and it happened to be a time when I was pregnant, my daughter now aged 20, and I was offered a way forward in my pediatrics training that was difficult to continue with. We don't need to go too much into that, but it was quite an inflexible pathway, and it was difficult and annoying. And so I started exploring other ways that I might pursue my interests. And so I explored public health. Anyway, I ended up doing both, which was great. And so it's allowed me to combine interests in a way which was really fun and really, I think, important. I think it's really important as a children's professional, children's health professional, doctor or whatever, to be able to think about the full spectrum of what happens to children, all the way from the things that shape their health and their illnesses, those determinants, through to how to prevent them and how to try and shape society better, all the way right up until the way that the health system works and healthcare itself. And so it's given me a really nice broad perspective on health, and so fortunately I've been able to carve out a career, a little bit unconventional, but it kind of catching on, which is nice.
I'm not sure who has a conventional path anymore.
I know, it's true.
Listen to, and also the thing you made me think about was that in the early years of my career, how many times I was asked, what's your 5-year plan? And that now I never had a really good answer. And now I don't even want a good answer because I'm looking for the next interesting thing. But anyway, to you, the stories that David and I have been listening to, you know, in our journey so far with the podcast, it's a very familiar tale about, well, one thing led to another, serendipity kicked in, you know. Mm-hmm. And but when people are looking back on the choices they've made, it seems that there's two quite big drivers. One is around a desire for about scale, so you can treat one child at a time, or you want to reach many more children and widen your impact that way. And then the other was around complexity. So what you're describing, or you know, someone else described as really complex, intractable problems, that it wasn't just healthcare, it was to do with poverty, it was to do with equality, inequality, it was to do with, you know, so many other different factors. And you know, listening to you talking about the sharp end of action and treating children versus my arm is reaching out across the office, you know, the right hand end of the bigger picture and policy, you know, it's really interesting. So what was the driver for you, more around scale or complexity or both?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think it's a little bit of both, but the scale question is an interesting one in a way, because yes, it's so where I think the scale question is important is in shining a light on the ordinary stuff. So, and why I think that's important and why that comes into scale is because often what happens is, especially towards the sort of sharper end of medicine, we tend to think more about the rare and the acute medical stuff. And we tend not to focus as much on the slightly less complicated, urgent, acute problems of childhood, the ordinary stuff, like what I said earlier about, you know, constipation, asthma, and so on. And also all the things that contribute to those sort of things, poverty and so on. So that the sort of lower level things that affect larger numbers of children, that's the key. Because if you shine a light on that ordinary stuff that affect larger numbers of children, you then have a chance of shifting the distribution of health outcomes. And why is that important? That's important because as a country, outcomes for children in this country are pretty poor compared with other high-income countries. And they're very good compared with many global health settings, but they are not good when you compare ourselves with other high-income European well-developed countries with universal health systems and so on. Our outcomes should be better than they are. We really languish at the lower end of performance. And that, I think, is embarrassing and risible. And what's even more important is that it's preventable. There isn't any magic potion that we lack. It's will. It's political will, largely. And so what do we need to do to fix that? We need to come back to the scale and scope question and impact. I think we need to do much better at understanding the complexity of what causes outcomes to be poor. There's a false dichotomy of it's either social determinants or health systems, which I think is wrong. I think it's everything feeds into it, and all of the spectrum of determinants, right the way from upstream down to downstream, i.e. healthcare, all of that can be better. We get into, I think, purposeless arguments about what component which bit is, you know, healthcare contributes 20% and other. First of all, I don't really believe those figures. And secondly, it doesn't really matter. All children end up one time or another in healthcare, and it could be better. And we have a huge problem, we have a huge problem with the social determinants of health. All that needs to be fixed. And they all affect each other, of course. So children who are disadvantaged because of their social circumstances are also disadvantaged in their in being able to access healthcare. So even though the quality of care may be good, they may struggle to access it. So social determinants needs to include access to healthcare. So there's a complexity and scale question about the range of things that you need to be considering. And in terms of impact, I think, you know, as I said, I think as a country, we have a lot of work to do to try and improve our standing. And, you know, as I said, I think really importantly, the lesson that somehow or other as a country, we found ourselves in a position of kind of bottom of the pack for no good reason. And that to me is really what drives my motivation. I think it's unacceptable.
And when you paint that picture, how are you not overwhelmed? And I don't mean from a personal perspective of, yeah, you know, how it makes you feel in your heart, but how do you wrap your arms around that? You described just a challenge of what feel like titanic proportions, and yet you get up every day and do something constructive to address that. So how do you break it down on a day-to-day basis?
I don't know. You do what you can do, and everybody has some way of contributing. I think, you know, I often think I'm going to digress slightly. I often think of life and the point of life as a kind of a set of scales. And everybody has the potential to add something to the positive side of the scale. And there's an awful lot of awfulness that is adding to the negative side. Some is preventable, some is not preventable. Nothing could have stopped the current virus that we're all battling against from emerging. So that just happened, but there are plenty of things that are preventable that are happening on the negative side of the scale. So I think each of us as a human being has got the potential to add something to the positive side of the scale. And I think it almost doesn't matter what you do, so long as you're adding to the positive and not the negative. Each of us, by being kind to our family and friends and neighbors and colleagues, is adding to the positive side of the scale. I think that's really important and should not be underestimated. And so in whatever way each of us can contribute towards the positive side of the scale, I think that's important. And each of us chooses to a certain extent, how we plan to add to that positive side of the scale. And then you're constrained by the, you know, the limits of reality and your life, and you want to have, you know, you've got lots of things to look after in life. So I chose to do it in the way that I chose to do it. And I chose to be a children's doctor, and I absolutely love that. And I chose to contribute in the way that I do, which is about trying to fix health systems and try to influence the stuff that sits beyond the health systems, which is the bigger stuff, the policy and the politics and poverty and all of those things. So I'm not in politics, and I wouldn't dream of doing so, but I do try to influence it because I think it has such a crucial bearing on health. So I think we have a role as advocates to speak out about what we think should be better for children. And then I directly work, as you know, in trying to improve the health system.
And on that note, from a positive perspective, you have started in the work that you're doing in the region of the UK, which we should probably talk a little bit about where you are working. Can you talk about the health partnership and the children's and young people's health partnership that you have set up and that you're actively working on, please?
Yes, sure. Thank you. So I'm a consultant at Evelina London Hospital. And that was a really fortunate thing that happened, because Evelina are interested in doing things that are a little bit different. They're interested in taking a chance. And it's now become quite a popular thing to call, you know, talk about population health management and all the rest of it. But it really wasn't at the outset. And so to take on a paediatrician who's really interested in public health was quite a new thing. So I owe them a huge debt of gratitude because they got interested in that sort of thing. And so we formed a partnership, as you said, which was comprised of, it's kind of an active learning partnership. I guess that's a nice way of describing it, which is kind of a new phrase for me. We used to call it a clinical academic partnership, but really it's about learning and doing. And so I quite like the way that phrase is evolving. So it's a group of hospitals and primary care and local authorities, and then the commissioners of healthcare. So they're the people who make decisions about how the system is going to respond to need, and where they're going to put their resources, and then at a university. So for the learning part of it, and then very importantly, citizens, so parents and carers and children and young people. So we formed this partnership to try to better understand how the health system could be shaped. And again, as I said before, to address the ordinary problems. So we're really interested in primary and secondary care for ordinary childhood problems. How can we do that better? How could we join it up better? How can we deliver better outcomes for children with common conditions, long-term conditions, and so on, in a way that was holistic? You know, so you're dealing with the child's physical health problem, but also their emotional well-being at the same time, because they're not separatable, even though the health system is constructed in a way that is really more about the interests of professionals than the interests or the needs of children or families. So, you know, you don't, as a human being, you don't think, well, let's see, my physical body is feeling like this, and my, you know, it's just nonsense. But that's the way we tend to deliver healthcare. And so we wanted to address things like that. And then, so we call it biopsychosocial care. And really all that means is body, mind, and your spirit, your social, you know, your social being. What is your environment like? How, you know, what is your life like in your family and community context? Because that, of course, has a bearing on your health. And so the perspective is health, but it's really about holistic well-being. We set about to try and change the system to allow that sort of joined up approach, both joined up in that kind of body, mind and social sense, but also to try to fix other things that we thought were really important, like the ability to intervene early. So instead of sitting in the health service behind a kind of wall and waiting for sick children to come in, which is, of course, the way it's designed, we thought, well, how can we do better at trying to find those children before they get so sick that they come in? And what about the children who, for whatever reason, don't have the wherewithal to come in? And I don't mean that just like in transport, but I mean, you know, their parents might be, you know, working three different jobs to try and put food on the table, and that everybody's very thinly stretched, and it's just really difficult to get to an appointment at a particular time in a particular place. I mean, that's not easy at the best of times, but there are an awful lot of families for whom that is just really very challenging. And so those are barriers in access to care. And so what can we do to try and improve access to care and deliver early intervention for children who need it before they get sick? And that's actually really hard to do. It took a lot of thinking and a lot of reorganizing how we conceptualize what care is. How do we use data better to find children earlier and reach out to them rather than wait for them to come in? So we try and get proactive about it. And so we've found a way of doing that, and I'm hugely proud of that. And one of the things that I think is really, really great about that is that we've been able to do that. We think we've been able to do that. It's still kind of early in terms of the evidence, but we think we've been able to do that in a way that helps us reduce inequalities. So what we're trying to do is to use data smarter to find children who have a harder time coming in. So not just are sicker, but who face those barriers in access to care. So what can we do to scoop up the children who need extra help and give them disproportionate help, you know, give them more help and they need more help. And so that we're trying to even things out a little bit. People say leveling up, and that's really what we're trying to do. So give a little bit more help to people who need a bit more help, rather than, unfortunately, what often happens is that people who need help are the last ones who get the help. And so we want to do that right.
And can you talk a bit more about that example that you've got in mind? So how, just talk us through something that's gone well and what that's meant for a child that you might not otherwise have known about.
Yeah, so, okay. So for example, children who live in socially disadvantaged circumstances, of which there are very many, have got complicated lives, like, you know, everybody does, but will face their parents, you know, will face extraordinarily complicated series of challenges in trying to do what they want to be able to do, what every parent wants to be able to do for their child. And so we've created a system that goes to them and helps them early, that asks them about their lives, not just about their health problem, that asks them about their lives, and then can provide a response that is tailored to what they need. So that response has a bit of physical health, a bit of mental and emotional well-being and health support, and a bit of social. So everything that, well, I mean, it's, you know, we haven't got a miracle cure for all these problems by any means, but what we're doing better than we have done before is a holistic and tailored package of care for a child who has got, for example, eczema, really bad eczema. And I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but children with really bad eczema, that's a huge problem. It might seem minor to a doctor, but it isn't to the child and family, because, you know, a parent might have to, first of all, they don't sleep well because they're itchy and uncomfortable. And then they might scratch themselves to the point where they bleed and their skin gets infected. The sheets have to be changed. If you don't have a washing machine, what does that mean? You know, the problems become enormous. And these often, you know, children with bad eczema are, you know, they're uncomfortable. So they feel miserable and they don't sleep well. And so then it affects everybody's happiness and well-being, and nobody sleeps and everybody gets tired and irritable. And it's hard to go to work when you're not, you know, you haven't slept, and it's hard to go to school when you're on, you know, all of that. So it becomes a big problem. And my point is that what looks like a medical thing, have these creams, do them this many times a day, if you look at it in that context, you realize, well, okay, wait a minute, a lot of things need to be sorted out here. So, you know, that if the child is living, for example, as is often the case, in circumstances where it's not so easy to wash your sheets every time that child bleeds on them, or where, you know, families who live in bed and breakfasts, for example, might not have access to their own bathroom or kitchen so that they can do all the creams and emollients and lotions and potions that are needed to look after eczema. Or, you know, you might talk about diet or whatever, and like, you know, the other example I gave about constipation, I mean, you know, so much of that comes down to diet and nutrition, and people frankly cannot afford the food that would be helpful for their children's digestive health. So just now in the news is all of this awful, awful stuff about free school meals, which has just been voted down by the government, you know, which, I mean, it leaves you speechless. How anybody could say no to feeding hungry children when they're not at school is beyond me. Now, I understand all the ideological things about, you know, what should the state do and what should not do, but, you know, come on, we've got hungry children in a rich country. That's not okay. And the only person who's really effectively voicing that problem is a 22-year-old football player. I mean, what a hero, what a public health hero he is for that. And he's holding our politicians to account. And I think we need to be doing a better job in the health world at speaking those stories, because we see the impact of it all the time. So what I'm trying to do in a small way, for at least for the children that we see in our health system, is to be cognizant of the complexity of those problems and to be able to respond in some sort of way that recognizes the complexity of people's lives, the things that shape children's lives and well-being and health, and to try and support that in a little bit more of a joined up way.
I think what's interesting about what you're achieving, though, is about how you're getting the structures to work, because we've heard a couple of brilliant stories recently. One was when we were talking about the Copenhagen Children's Hospital and the setup they got there, and the other one was with Africa, with that setup. And so with the African setup, the kids were getting AM or PM appointments, and they'd get invited in for either morning or afternoon. They'd come in with their family, their siblings, their neighbours, because it's like it's an event, and they'd all come in. And DCM, I actually can't remember the lady's name that we were talking to, Jo. Yeah. And Jo was brilliant. She said she spends half her day just scrambling around on, you know, on her hands and knees, and she would be adjusting the height of a wheelchair or whatever. But it was about bringing the right experts at, you know, when the child was ready to interact, bring the right experts around that child. And the concept that and that we were talking about with the Copenhagen Children's Hospital was the concept of a Formula One car, and when the car comes in for a pit stop, and then all of the specialists support that. And that's just, you know, for most kids, that's not what happens. First of all, you manage to get them to the hospital, which you've pointed out is just actually not going to happen for many of these kids. It's just too tricky for all of those other reasons. But you get there and then you wait for a bit, and then you get the first appointment and so on. And then your morning's gone, and the kid might not have been. I mean, Oscar used to always perform when we were in that environment. It was so annoying that we knew he was poorly, and then he'd come out with jazz hands and, you know, just get a bit sparkly eyed. And it's incredibly unhelpful, because we need people to look at you and understand what's wrong. So, But this idea of the Formula One car, or how Joe was able to do it in Africa, I couldn't see how that translated to the NHS and how we work. But somehow you've managed to do that.
Well, it's a really good analogy, actually. So bringing the service to the child rather than the other way around. And that's exactly right. And I might have to borrow that analogy, but it's true, because the health system has been constructed largely around professional organizational interests, frankly. And so you get into these kind of really stupid arguments about, you know, what does a pediatrician do that's different from a general practitioner, and you can't, and it has to be hierarchical, and it has to be, you know, with boundaries and so on. And we've moved a lot in that argument. But, you know, once upon a time, 10, 15 years ago, that was a really big no-no. And similarly with physical health and mental health and nursing and doctors, and, you know, all of these sort of false divisions, you know, that are really more about preserving professional self-interest or organizational self-interest. Now, this is where the politics matters, because legislation in this country mitigates against cooperation. And it is as stupid as stupid can be. So It actually fosters competition, because of this misguided idea that competition improves quality. And I get that, the market works when you're buying bread or fruit or whatever, because you can, you know, because it's a simple transaction and you can understand the quality of what you are buying and the price of it. That doesn't work in health. It just does not work in the same way. You cannot measure quality as simplistically as you would like to be able to measure. It just doesn't work. So, you know, we have all kinds of proxy measures some of which are better than others, some of them are pretty useless, frankly. And even cost, you know, that's an incredibly difficult thing to measure in order to be able to actually decide what is better value for whom and in what way and how do you actually come up with the price of it. So it's all a bit sort of simplistic to try and introduce that. Now, it's not to say that we should all be complacent and not have to strive to improve. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that is the wrong lever to try to improve quality. Competition is the wrong fiscal competition, or whatever, if that's even the right word, but you know, a marketized competition is not the right way, in my view, to improve quality. It has not been shown to work in any health system in the world. It just increases transaction costs and widens inequalities usually. So that was a bit of a digression, but what I mean is that the system is set up in such a way to make it harder to cooperate when that's really what the child needs. It makes it harder for organizations, for example, to think about quality of care when, for example, as has been the case up until the pandemic struck, which is an interesting point, the way that hospitals were financed was by activity. So if you see this many children and this many clinic appointments, that's your, you know, that relates to your income, basically. And I get that, but you can see immediately that there's an incentive to do more, not less. So if what you're trying to do is improve health and prevent them coming up to care, I mean, you know, the problem is huge. So even with the most stellar success, not going to be able to reduce things, you know, so profoundly that hospitals are imperiled in their income streams. But nonetheless, it's not set up right to try to achieve what we want to achieve. So when people say these slightly sort of facile statements like, oh, we need a health service rather than a sickness service, well, that's the kind of thing that needs to be fixed. We need to fix the way we structure the system. And I think actually there's a bit of progress being made on that now, partly because I think that there were some very good strategies that came along, the NHS long-term plan being one. And it's actually pretty good. You know, it tries to get around some of the unhelpful legislation without having to undo legislation, which is a, you know, got all kinds of other complications, but it does try and get around it by introducing things like integrated care structures. Now, some people worry about them. I don't. And that's another, sort of topic to get into, but I think it's an important step forward because it's about joining things up better. Now, it is just to go back to what I said, I was not going to get into why are people worried about integrated care systems. So I think what's really important to say is, yes, we need to be joined up in an organization that is coherent, that brings together organizations and professionals. Absolutely, it does. But what then needs to happen is that needs to be run by and through the public sector for the public interest. And the reason people have got worried about integrated care is because it looks like parceling up bits of the health service to be privatized. And there are reasons, very sensible and justifiable reasons, to be worried about that, quite frankly. But I think that we need to separate those things out. I do think we need to be much more joined up than we are, and we're getting there, quite frankly. So a lot of policy at the moment is about producing those sort of structures. And it's an uncomfortable process to arrive at that, because you have to reform a lot of things, like the payment model, for example, and come up with a way that incentivizes things in the right way rather than unhelpful way. And people always sort of find a way to get around things like that, but we shouldn't have to. The system should be structured in such a way to help achieve what we want to achieve for children.
I've got a question for you about, so those that are listening to our podcast might be, majority medical professionals. They might be in the early stages of their career, could be paediatricians, neonatal specialists, could be entrepreneurs. There'll be, you know, a few parents, and most people are going to be in the medical field. And the question I had for you was, for somebody that's listening to this podcast today, what ideas would you have for what could they do to put something onto the right hand side of the scale in the context of fixing this gargantuan challenge that we have, but, you know, with a positive mindset, you know, what can one person do?
Gosh, what can one person do? Well, so everybody, I think, has to find their solution to that. The important thing, I think, is not to let go of that goal. And so you shouldn't be afraid of contributing in the smallest possible way. You know, everybody can practice differently. So, you know, a children's doctor or nurse or GP or whatever can practice in a more holistic and joined up way. Try and think beyond the immediate, which is so hard and getting harder. You know, the pressure is rising and there are all kinds of challenges and difficulties. But I think it's really important to be able to look up every now and again from the thing that you're focused on and try and think about the bigger picture and what are you actually doing. And I suppose the other thing I think is important, and this is not really about advice for one person, but you know, I guess each one of the one people, and that is to, I think what we could do better in the child health community is to speak with a more of a coherent voice. I think the children's community voice is fragmented, and that's not helpful. So we have, you know, all of these various different royal colleges and so on that represent professions, and children, of course, need bits from each of them. And so that becomes very complicated because they don't speak with one voice. And that is unhelpful, in my view. And then there's a dichotomy also between health and schools, for example. And, you know, all there are too many voices talking about all of the various things that are important. And I think there should be, it would be really helpful if we could coordinate a little bit better, because we need to speak much more loudly about what's going on with children and get our voice across much more effectively. And in order to do that, I think we need to join forces much more effectively than we currently do. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, we can certainly we've wholeheartedly agree, I think, with those points. And it just makes me think about lots of industries who and organizations that struggle to, you know, bring various services that they might have together and trying to do that for their common purpose, whether it be for children or their customers or whomever it might be. You mentioned it as a kind of cliche, but I think in terms of people understanding, what you are trying to do is, you know, is proper healthcare as opposed to the service that we have and most health services has across the world, which is sick care. And I think that's, although it is, as I say, a cliche, but it is a really good way of understanding the difference in terms of bringing that care to people and that kind of preventative agenda. And I think we talk a lot about the preventative agenda, you know, in all manners of our kind of everyday life, about the importance of actually, if we can help children to be healthy at an early age, what is the opportunity then in later life to A, not be a burden on the health service, but more importantly, that they live a fuller and more complete life moving forward. Now, when we discussed this previously, you had a really interesting point, which is that, you know, talking about the preventative agenda and children and helping them at an early age kind of misses the point and the rights of the child. Can you just touch on that for me a little bit, please?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. It was a really nice sort of twist to the conversation. And I think it's really important because when you read about, you read in policy documents and all sorts of things about why should we do this? And people come up with all kinds of really clever and very reasonable justifications for why it's important to invest in the early years, why it's important to invest in prevention. And what I see often, which I don't disagree with, I just think it's incomplete, is this notion that we should invest in early years because they lay the foundations for adulthood. I mean, that's true, of course, incontrovertibly that's true. But, you know, this is what I really love the name of your podcast, because I think there's more to it. I think children in their own right deserve it. It's not just because they're going to become adults, it's because they have intrinsic value in and of themselves. And that point gets missed. In fact, you know, one thing that I think that really disturbs me is that child rights, sometimes if you talk to certain politicians and you know, people about things like that, there's a little bit of eye rolling going on, you know, child rights, what are you talking about? You know, but you look back 100 years ago and it was the same with women's rights. Well, you know, once upon a time, it was completely legitimate for a husband to hit his wife because, you know, it was property more or less. And now we just think, what? You know, how completely outrageous. Well, the same exists now for children. And I would like to live long enough to see that change, whereby it is children are protected for their own selves, just as much as now we have, at least in law, protection for women. And, you know, we haven't quite achieved it to be realized in the way that it might be. But, you know, at least in law, it stands that way. And, you know, we're supposed to have equal rights. We're supposed to have met between men and women. We're supposed to have equal pay and all that. It doesn't really translate yet, but it will, because changing the law is an important signal. And this is why I think it, oh, sorry, interrupted you.
No, I was getting excited. I didn't mean to butt in. Carry on.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important, isn't it? And so I think this comes down to this sort of vexed argument about hitting children or smacking. And I do not like the word smacking because it makes it sound like it trivializes it. Smacking is hitting. And I just think it sends the worst signal that that's legal. Now, it's not that I think everybody should be prosecuted and I'm not talking about a police state, nothing like that. What I'm talking about is finding better ways to achieve what people say is the reason they want that to continue to be part of their repertoire of parenting techniques. Now, this is a huge, we could have a whole podcast about this, which we're not going to have, but my point is, it's about the rights of the child. The child deserves the same rights of protection as any other human being. They should not be hit. End of story. You know, and for people who say the frank nonsense about, well, it's to do with child rearing everything, no, it isn't. It's to do with parental frustration, which I do understand, but it's not an effective means of parenting. That's been shown again and again and again. It's usually just what happens when parents reach the end of their tethers. And then what does it do? It legitimizes violence. So we're now having that podcast, which we're not going to have. But my point is My point is rights. My point is the rights of the child really need to come up on the agenda, because it sets a signal for the value that we place on children, and therefore what we do about the problems that they have that we could be correcting.
The way you've articulated it is really helpful. We participated in a hackathon a couple of years ago at the University of Oxford and the Innovation Forum. And the purpose was about spending a day, there was about 50 individuals there, it was a long day on a Saturday, and it was flushing out ideas of what could we do that is innovative, that improves outcomes for child health. And I had gone in there really excited because my vision was that we would get to the end of the day and there'd be a list of ideas, and there'd be some quite bite-sized ones that Thinking of Oscar could afford to fund, and there'd be other VCs that could pick up the meatier ones and they go off and make those happen. And naturally we didn't get even close to ideas like that. What we did do was that people went out into the roads around where we had this meeting taking place, and they interviewed families that they bumped into on their travels, and they came back, and the consensus of the day, and it was unanimous across the room, was that the common theme was around empowerment of children. And at the time my reaction honestly was, like, it just seemed a bit fluffy and I wanted something to spend money on, but I completely missed the point. And I've seen it happen time and time again and understood better and better about how important that is. And it's nothing to do with pandering to a child, or it is about that, you know, we think of an example in a hospital environment or whenever their health is the matter of conversation, there are many things that they don't get to make any choices about.
Yes.
And so if you can give them an opportunity to feel empowered in any way, because if they're sick and they need to get a treatment, and it might not be very nice, but we all know it's what they have to do to make them better, they're not going to get a choice there, but can they get a choice here instead? And we understand how important that is to us as human beings, and as you say, they turn out to be human beings as well. It's not at all trivial. It's absolutely
yes,
essential.
It is. It's fundamental, isn't it? And I know just what you mean about this kind of like eye-opening moment when you sort of think, oh, yes, of course. You know, and one of the things that really drew me to pediatrics, one of the things I love about children is their wisdom and ability to cut through the nonsense that, you know, when you get into the busy adult years of life, you sort of forget, you know, and there's a wonderful kind of meeting of minds between children and very old people in that sort of wisdom of just seeing it for what it is. You know, you ask a child whether they like someone or not, they will tell you straight out. And I love that. And that's one of the things I love about being a pediatrician is because, it, you know, it's just, there's no nonsense about it. You know, they will not cooperate with you unless you are decent to them and quite right too, right? So anyway, that's really a sort of circuitous way of saying they should be heard and listened to and respected for their wisdom, quite frankly, because they sometimes can see the truths that we got too busy or too cynical or whatever to notice anymore. So we need to listen much better to the truths that peel away all the nonsense that occupies our adult lives sometimes and listen to what people who see the truth and goodness of things straight.
Yeah, so true.
Ingrid, we could literally talk to you for hours, and I feel like there's so many areas that we haven't touched upon yet that we could have done. But there's one question that we ask everybody that comes onto the podcast, and that is, if you could change anything within children's health or well-being, what would that be? If you had that kind of magic wand.
Oh well. I think that's just what we were just talking about. I would like to change the way that we as a culture understand and appreciate the value of children. I think that's really important because I think out of that stems all of the other stuff. Because do you remember where we started in the conversation about talking about the problems of outcomes and why are our children's outcomes so poor in this country compared with other wealthy countries? And there isn't any kind of insurmountable problem that explains it. We could have better outcomes, but we don't. And I think if we properly addressed the problem of our not valuing children appropriately in society, we could address that. I think all the other things would follow. If children had a proper voice at the table and children's interests were represented properly, then I think all of the other problems would be solved. And so, if your next question is going to be, well, how do you achieve that? and that is challenging. I think one way we could achieve that, again, is something we touched on, which is for all of us who are interested in and want to try to do something to improve the lives of children could speak with a more coherent voice. That would be really wonderful. If we could stop worrying about the organizations and the professions and the money and the this and the that, and we could organize ourselves to speak properly with one joined up and much louder, more effective voice, then I would be very pleased.
Thank you, Ingrid. It's been a fascinating conversation this afternoon. We've loved it, as you tell from our beaming faces across Zoom.
So. Oh, thank you so much. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed talking with you both. It was really, really a pleasure.
No, absolutely. The reason why we called this podcast, not just the Not Mini Adults podcast, but Children's Healthcare and Wellbeing, Pioneers for Children's Healthcare and Wellbeing, was so that we could talk to people like you, you know, really just not just about what's happening in the hospital setting, but the well-being of children in totality. And so for that reason, we're so grateful. And, you know, thank you so much.
Well, goodness, thank you for the opportunity and really best of luck with what you're trying to achieve. And I'd be only too happy to contribute in any small way that I could. So let me know.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us on this week's episode of the Not Mini Adults podcast. And of course, a big thank you to Dr. Ingrid Wolf for joining us this week, but also for all the amazing work that she's doing for the well-being of children. If there is someone that you think that we should be talking to, or if there's a topic that you'd like us to cover, then please do get in touch with us. And again, you can find all of our contact details in the show notes as well. If you do enjoy these podcasts, then please share them with colleagues and friends or anyone else that you think might be interested. Next week on the podcast, we talk to an entrepreneurial team who are using technology to look after patients outside of the hospital setting. We hope that you can join us again soon.